That it's even out there is really the disturbing part. It's un-Alaskan. It's greedy. It's the same people that have been doing this for years.
Setnetters say they'll fight a ballot initiative that would ban their type of fishing on the Kenai. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, health insurance companies issue refunds to thousands of Alaskans.
It was holy smokes, wow. Thank you, Affordable Health Care Act.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service.
It was standing room only at an Anchorage debate on whether to keep the new capped oil tax rate or to switch back to a system where the rate goes up along with the profits. It was an unusually large and even occasionally rowdy crowd for the subject matter, but with voters deciding how they want to manage the bulk of the state's revenue in less than a month, the stakes are high. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Even after turning away dozens of people, the Alaska Common Ground Forum on Wednesday night was still close to violating fire code. The two-hour debate had State Senator Bill Willikowski and economist Greg Erickson making the case for repealing Senate Bill 21. That law was passed last year as a priority of the Parnell administration, and it puts a tax ceiling of 35% on oil company profits. The pair argued that tax rates have had little effect on production historically, and that Alaska was a profitable place to operate, even when the state had a windfall system that taxed profits as much as 75% when prices were high. Erickson also accused the oil companies of using scare tactics by suggesting that the development of a natural gas mega project depended on the failure of the repeal. And he recalled similar rhetoric used in 2006 when voters considered a gas tax initiative.
The oil companies, particularly ConocoPhillips, paid millions of dollars for ads that said, "You pass this initiative, folks, there'll never be a gas line." Well, voters of Alaska took that to heart and declined to pass that initiative. Folks, we still don't have a gas line. And they've been telling us that same thing. They told us the same thing every time we've proposed a change in the oil tax regime.
The opposing side was represented by oil and gas consultants Roger Marks and Brad Keithley, who countered that tax incentives can encourage production and in turn bring in more state revenue. Keithley explained that the ACES tax system had a Robin Hood effect, redirecting state money from proven oil fields to areas that may not be profitable to produce. The pair was also asked to explain why the oil companies were spending more than $10 million to defeat the referendum. Keithley's response was met with some skepticism by the repeal-friendly crowd.
I don't think the oil companies are scared. I think the oil companies realize the resource potential of Alaska. I think they realize the potential to continue to develop additional oil in this state. They are investing the money in the public campaign to try to educate Alaskans on what the opportunity is. And I would do the same thing if I were in business.
Even after an hour and a half of the two sides going back and forth, answering questions from moderator and University of Alaska professor Gunnar Knapp, and prodding each other, the audience still wanted to hear more. Knapp was able to get to a handful of the questions submitted.
I understand that we have 174 questions. Luckily, we
have to stay all night, Gunnar.
Until 2:45 a.m., these folks have agreed to stay. So, no, seriously, we can only, unfortunately, address a fraction of the huge number of questions we've gotten.
The oil tax referendum is one of the marquee issues of this election season. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Byron Mallotte and independent candidate Bill Walker were both in the audience. Both have come out in favor of the repeal measure, which will be put to voters on August 19th. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The push to ban commercial set netting moved another step forward this week. A Superior Court judge in Anchorage ruled yesterday that the Alaska Fisheries Conservation Alliance can begin collecting signatures for a ballot initiative so voters can decide about the value of commercial set net fishing in Cook Inlet. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
You can go back decades to get to the beginning of this, but the past few years are arguably some of the most important. Dramatically low returns of king salmon to Cook Inlet have driven a huge wedge between sport fishermen and their commercial counterparts, in particular the Eastside Setnet fleet that operates along about 70 miles of coast from Nikiski to Nanilchik.
That it's even out there is really the disturbing part. It's un-Alaskan. It's greedy. It's the same people that have been doing this for years.
That's Andy Hall, president of the board of directors for the Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association. That group represents many of the set netters who could be forced out of the water if the initiative is approved by voters in a couple of years. The group doing the forcing is the Alaska Fisheries Conservation Alliance. It's made up of sport fishing interests, many of whom have been battling the commercial fleets over access to salmon stocks for years. Joe Connors is the president of that board. I caught up with him, fittingly, outside Trustworthy Hardware and Tackle Store in Soldotna, a popular spot for the sport fishing crowd.
We don't have a fight with commercial fishing. We have a fight with a particular type of fishing in urban areas of Alaska. It's beyond its time.
The next step is drafting the language of the initiative and getting the signatures. Connor says they'll have to find about 35,000 registered voters to sign on. The alliance has already laid out the basic tenets of what it wants on a ballot measure: to ban commercial set netting in urban areas of the state. In this case, urban areas are defined as Fairbanks, Juneau, Valdez, Ketchikan, and also the areas surrounding Anchorage, the Matsu Borough, and the Kenai Peninsula Borough. So while it will technically apply statewide, in function, it applies most to fishermen on the Kenai.
To say that cutting out 700-plus family fishing businesses and a fishery that's been around for 130 years because somebody wants everything and can't share, it just is kind of sad, actually.
Hall says he's hopeful that the state will appeal the decision to the Supreme Court, and because salmon is a natural resource like oil or gas or minerals, it's a bad idea to have voters determine its management at the ballot. But Connors says the state has always invited the public into fishing decisions dating to before statehood.
I would suspect that a lot of people in Alaska just really don't even have an opinion, and they don't know much about the fishery. So it's going to be up to us to educate the public, and that we have every intention of doing that. We're going to explain what goes on in this fishery that makes this fishery different than other fisheries. I mean, some of them are doing a phenomenal job, and yet here, this one it hasn't changed. I mean, it's a fishery that needs to go away because it kills everything.
The day after the decision was handed down by Superior Court Judge Catherine Easter, the Department of Fish and Game issued an emergency order closing almost all set net fishing on Cook Inlet's east side until further notice in order to preserve the measly run of king still coming into the Kenai River. Hall says this year has been an improvement over the past couple, but he and others are still struggling to break even. Meanwhile, sport guides, whose numbers have shrunk right in line with the king salmon decline, are still prohibited from targeting the few kings that are making it back. If the initiative process goes forward as planned, voters will make the final decision during the August 2016 primaries. In Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, residents of Allakaket fight the proposed Ambler Road.
We feel it's irresponsible development, and it'll harm so many populations of game animals.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
An investigation continues into what caused a tourist train to derail along a mountain pass north of Skagway yesterday, injuring 19 passengers. Margaret Friedenauer of KHNS has more.
The White Pass and Yukon route excursion Wednesday included 15 rail cars transporting 360 passengers and crew on a trip between Skagway and Fraser, British Columbia. Two locomotives went off the tracks, derailing the four passenger cars behind it as well. It happened about 20 miles north of Skagway along the 3,000-foot White Pass summit. Reporter Katie Emmets covered the story for the Skagway newspaper. She spoke with some of the 19 passengers injured after they were treated at the Skagway clinic. They explained how the derailed cars tipped over toward a lake running along the tracks.
Two of the passengers on the train were on the platform and got thrown into the lake. And it was a very small lake, but they were still thrown into the lake, and they were fine. I did speak to a passenger yesterday who was in the third car that slightly derailed, and he had some bruising on his hip, and his back was sore, he said. But other than that, he was just mostly shaken up mentally, not physically.
Word of the derailment Wednesday afternoon at first prompted serious concerns. Coast Guard Air Station Sitka was put on alert to assist if necessary, and Bartlett Regional Hospital in Juneau went into incident command and was told to expect as many as 24 patients. The hospital received word less than an hour later to stand down. White Pass Company officials say crew members were able to detach the derailed cars, bring in another locomotive, and transport all passengers back to Skagway. The company is investigating the cause, according to a press release. The railroad, which serves hundreds of passengers each day, suspended operations until Friday. The Canadian corporation that owns the railroad said in a statement Thursday, all required regulatory reporting requirements concerning the derailment have been met, and the company has notified its insurer. The White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad was built in 1898 during the Klondike Gold Rush. Now it serves as one of Skagway's primary scenic attractions for visitors, bringing thousands of passengers over White Pass Mountain Summit between Skagway and Yukon each year. Reporting in Haines, I'm Margaret Friedenauer.
Tribal leaders are gathering interested parties, including state and federal officials, in the village of Allakaket to discuss the state's proposed road into the Ambler Mining District. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, Upper Koyukuk River people are concerned about impacts to subsistence resources by the road and mining development it would bring.
The Parnell Administration Roads to Resources project would run 200 miles west off the Dalton Highway into remote country south of the Brooks Range, passing near the village of Allakaket. Tenarnaw Chiefs Conference Executive Board Member and Allakaket Second Chief P.J. Simon says there are a lot of concerns about the road.
We've passed resolutions through the city and the tribe of Allakaket against this road just because we feel it's irresponsible development and it'll harm so many populations of game animals and also disrupt the flora and fauna of the Southern Brooks Range, which I feel is the lungs of the planet, the boreal forest.
Representatives from numerous state and federal agencies, as well as tribal and environmental organizations and construction contractors, are slated to come to Allakaket to talk about the proposed road project. Simon cites specific concerns about effects on Yukon River salmon stocks, whitefish and already declining caribou herds, as well as general impacts to valued wilderness.
We have floaters from all over the world float the Allakaket, the Koyukuk Rivers, and also the Alatna River, and we're okay with that. They're okay with that. You know, the last pristine area in the United States of America, in my opinion.
Simon says area villagers are also worried about the state spending money on a road during tight budgetary times. The state estimates it'll cost between $190 million and $300 million to build the Ambler Road, but Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority spokesman Karsten Rodvik says none of it'll come from the general fund.
We anticipate that this is going to be a 3P or a public-private partnership undertaking, and whereby we would work with the private sector to finance, design, construct, and operate the proposed access road. The cost for the road development and maintenance would be paid by tolls from road users.
Ada is shepherding the Ambler Access Road, a project Rodvik says fits the state corporation's role as a facilitator of economic development. The road would traverse a mix of state, federal, and native corporation lands to access a region Rodvik says private industry is interested in developing.
The Ambler Mining District is an area that has rich mineral resources, including copper, zinc, lead, and gold. The area has been identified as a high-value resource area for many decades, and exploration has occurred in several areas. There are a number of known large prospects, including the Arctic, Bornite, Sun, and Smucker prospects.
Rodvik says the single-lane gravel road would be limited to industrial use, including by companies that could truck fuel and goods to some area communities, depending on the finalized route. Rodvik, who's scheduled to be in Allakaket, says the state is there to listen and answer questions. He says Ada has held over 30 of its own public meetings and plans to apply for a federal environmental impact statement for the Ambler Road later this year. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
More than 11,000 Alaskans are getting refunds from their health insurance company. As part of the Affordable Care Act, companies have to spend at least 80% of premium dollars on medical care and wellness. If they don't hit that target, they are required to send refunds to customers. The average refund amount in Alaska is nearly $400 per family. Premier Alaska has already sent checks to more than 6,000 current and former members. Spokesperson Melanie Kuhn says customers in Alaska didn't use as much health care as the company expected last year.
Our experience in Alaska has been that the healthcare cost trends, especially in the individual market, can vary significantly from year to year. So, you know, we'd like to be right on, but it's always positive when you can say, you know what, people didn't spend as much, so we're giving you that money back. That's your money, and we're giving it back.
Kuhn says the company also works to keep administrative costs down. Christine Kennedy is an Anchorage resident who used to buy an individual health plan from Primera. Earlier this month, she was sifting through her mail when she found a letter from the company. She says she thought it was a survey asking her why she canceled her plan.
I just assumed this was another follow-up letter, and I opened the envelope, and lo and behold, it's a refund check. So for the first time in years, after watching our rates go up at least 15% per year, it was, holy smokes, wow, thank you, Affordable Health Care Act.
Kennedy's refund was for $169. The two other companies issuing refunds in Alaska are the Mega Life and Health Insurance Company and Time Insurance Company.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The Pacific Northwest Economic Region, or PENWAR, Summit is happening right now in Whistler, British Columbia. The annual gathering of business leaders and politicians from Western Canada and the Northwest states alternates between the two countries each year. Last year, meetings were in Anchorage. At least 11 of Alaska's legislators are attending this year's conference. Gas and Arctic issues are a big focus this year. David Ramsey is the Northwest Territories Minister of Industry, Tourism, and Investment and the newly appointed PENWAR President. Ramsey says the Northwest Territories and Alaska have a lot in common. Small population in a large area rich in resources, many of them stranded. He says the focus in the Northwest Territories has shifted to oil because lower gas prices has left their McKinsey gas line proposal sitting on a shelf.
At some point in time, that might change, but for now, I think we've got to switch gears and put our focus into oil and the prospect of perhaps an oil pipeline north from Alberta, which would get close to the Beaufort coast and then through the Yukon and into Alaska. And that's the discussion that I think really needs to happen.
Ramsey says greening the supply chain is an important industry initiative because Alaska and Canada are on the front lines of climate change. He says alternative fuels and hydro development can help mitigate global warming and create jobs. He says a focus of his year-long presidency will be to encourage greater participation by Native communities.
I'd like to see representatives from each of the 10 jurisdictions in Penwar have Aboriginal leaders come to the conference and participate. And I think it's very healthy for the organization to be doing that. And also it helps connect the Aboriginal leaders to a myriad of business leaders that are involved in Penwar, and also legislators that are involved in Penwar, decision makers.
Ramsey says Arctic security and the current situation with Russia are a big concern, saying it's frightening that cooperation with Russia in the Arctic may not be forthcoming. The Penwar summit wraps up tomorrow. With chum salmon surging through much of western Alaska, commercial openings are having dramatically different effects, from a price spike in Kotzebue to frustration toward managers in the upper Yukon. From KNOM in Nome, Zachariah Hughes reports.
Jim Menard oversees the Kotzebue subdistrict for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Even though it's still early in the season, the escapement goal is already halfway met there, but the high numbers may have more to do with economics than biology. Though it's a decently strong run, the price per pound of salmon in Kotzebue is up to 78 cents.
The average price last year was 27 cents, so we're almost three times higher, which is resulted in a much greater fishing effort.
Menard says he hasn't seen this many permits issued for commercial fishing in Kotzebue since the price peaked in the late 80s. Chum fisheries across western Alaska are distinct, and high escapement counts in one management area don't affect decisions for others. But with high chum returns leading ADF&G to announce more commercial openings recently, subsistence users in some regions say their concerns aren't being adequately addressed. During a teleconference arranged by the Yukon River Drainage's Fisheries Association on Tuesday, news was shared that the first Chinook has been spotted in Whitehorse, Canada, yet another sign that the King Run in interior Alaska is nearly over. That should mean gear openings for subsistence users targeting chums. Several callers from middle and upriver communities like Galena's Fred Huntington challenged managers from ADF&G on decisions to open commercial fishing on the lower Yukon amid lingering subsistence restrictions and thin chum returns.
I mean, I'm not the only one I'm speaking for, but there's a whole bunch of people up here pretty frustrated because they're not able to fish, and right now the water's so high, nobody's getting any fish whatsoever. We're all the way through the whole summer, and I harvest three chums.
Throughout the teleconference, managers were desperate to explain that their decisions about commercial openings aren't ignoring subsistence needs, but are merely trying to balance diverse management strategies spanning the 1,000 miles of river. Jeff Estenson with ADF&G explains the department is canceling a commercial opening that was planned in the lower Yukon because strong southwest winds the last week and a half have pushed an early group of fall chum towards the mouth of the river.
We want to be able to look at spreading the harvest out a little bit. And as we've been saying all along, that you know we really are looking to get some of these early fall chum run up river for subsistence.
Those fall chum are genetically distinct from summer chum. They're bigger, more oily, and head further upriver to spawn, filling fish racks in the upper river all the way into Canada. Summer chum, by contrast, don't travel as far from the ocean to reproduce. And this season, the returns in the Norton Sound have been strong enough for managers to extend commercial openings.
The plan was to have like a super period to try to mitigate for a lot of the foregone harvest opportunity on chum salmon at the start of the season when they're commingling with the king salmon.
Area biologist Scott Kent says recent high water and bad weather not only stopped most of Fish and Game's counting projects in the Norton Sound, it effectively halted the commercial harvest. In Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A group of Japanese fishermen is touring the Northwest United States to get an education in fisheries. The group's first stop was Juneau, where they toured the hatchery at Daipac yesterday morning. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
37-year-old Fumihiro Sugawara is a chum salmon fisherman in Rausu, which is located in the northeast of Hokkaido Island in Japan. He's been fishing for 16 years. He and 12 other Japanese fishermen are visiting Alaska for the first time.
In the last few years, the amount of the salmons, trout, are declining. So they want to learn some of their idea from Alaskan salmon fish industry and to enhance their business in Japan.
Sugawara says he's learned a lot after touring Daipac's McCully Hatchery.
He was impressed by the way they catch directly from the ocean and then release directly into ocean.
In Japan, hatcheries release juvenile chum salmon into rivers. In Alaska, they're released in the open ocean. The group also heard presentations by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Sam Raybung is the state's hatchery program coordinator.
Alaska's hatchery program is unique, and Alaska's salmon fisheries are unique. We manage differently than just about anywhere else in the world.
Alaska's fisheries are managed to maintain the wild stock population.
It's a really strange concept to a lot of people from around the world who are more familiar with just harvesting quotas. We don't want to forego harvest opportunity, and conversely, if there are unanticipated weak runs, we can rein things in.
Raybung says the more people from around the world know about Alaska fisheries, the better.
We think it's important that other countries realize that our fisheries are managed sustainably. They always have been. It's not new to us. It's in our constitution, and it's one of the reasons we're a state. And we think it's important to spread that message.
Shunji Murakami is traveling with the fishermen as the group's main interpreter. He's based in Japan and is a consultant for the Wild Salmon Center, a Portland-based nonprofit that works to protect wild salmon and the ecosystems they depend on.
Alaska is such a rich country in terms of the environment for the salmon. But in Japan, 98% of our rivers are dammed, and we have a scarcity of wild salmon population.
He says the group of young fishermen came to Alaska to learn from the best. The hope is they will spread the message of sustainability to others back home.
We cannot apply Alaskan way of resource management like 100% to Japan, but to some extent, we could kind of learn from the resource management what's going on here and apply that in Japan, where environmentally a little bit poor, to rehabilitate the wild populations.
The Japanese fishermen want to expand their international market. One of the ways of doing that is getting their fish certified by the Marine Stewardship Council. Murakami says that's another incentive to make their fisheries more sustainable.
So then they can make money at the same time doing the right thing.
The group travels next to Sitka to meet with the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. They'll also go to Portland and visit the Bonneville Hatchery, which is run by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We're online at alaskapublic.org and on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Aldrin. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Crowley, fueling Alaska for more than 60 years with a full range of residential, commercial, aviation, and marine fuel products. Crowley also fuels community events, from summer fun runs to public radio. More at CrowleyFuels.com.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. You may be eligible for VA health care benefits, including reimbursement for your care at 26 tribal health care facilities and their 180-plus outlying clinics manned by providers and community health aides throughout the state of Alaska. Apply online at 1010ez.med.va.gov. Call 257-3323 for questions. This message sponsored by the VA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.